I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Award-winning playwright Chiara Alegría-Hudis grew up in West Philadelphia in a neighborhood where many languages were spoken. Her Puerto Rican mother and Jewish father moved the family to Malvern, Pennsylvania. And when they split up, Chiara traveled back and forth between the suburbs where her father lived and North Philadelphia where her mother and extended family lived, juggling languages and identities and cultures. She writes in her memoir, My Broken Language, that she was a migrant in her own life. She also writes about finding her voice in the sea of languages, the powerful Latina women who have shaped her, and her path to writing. She received a Pulitzer Prize for her 2012 play, Water by the Spoonful. More than a decade ago, she collaborated with Lin-Manuel Miranda, writing the script for their Tony Award-winning musical, In the Heights. She wrote the screenplay for the movie version that came out last summer. Chiara Alegría-Hudis' memoir was chosen for this year's One Book, One Philadelphia, featuring all sorts of author events. I spoke with Hudis last spring about her life, her writing, the theater, and the many characters she has created. We replay that interview today on Radio Times. I asked her why she felt it was the right time to write a memoir. Here's what she said in response.
For me, I'm not a reporter. I can't make sense about the thing as I'm living through it. So the hindsight helped. These were times that were very love-filled for me. They were full of dance, full of humble recipes like rice and beans, oral histories from the island of Puerto Rico. But they were also filled with things like AIDS, gun violence, addiction. I didn't understand those things as a child. And I think even the grown-ups around me were still making sense of it all because it was so new. I can look back on it now with a little more clarity. So I said, let me tell my story.
Well, I'm glad you did. Are there pieces of you, though, in the plays that you've written or pieces of your family that are in the plays that you have written?
Yes, I have. You know, one thing I loved growing up in my family is they're amazing storytellers. Yeah. And they were full of such rich histories that I wasn't finding in my high school textbooks. And so I said, well, tell me more. And that's how I end up writing a play about Puerto Rican men in the United States Marines. That's how I end up writing a play about protest in North Philly when the health services are failing the community. These come out of family interviews and family stories.
It's interesting to think, and I think about playwriting or screenwriting, which you have done as well, as so collaborative. You have to work with other people, whereas writing a memoir, it's you, your pen, your computer, and the page. What was that like for you?
You know, the thing that's fun about being a playwright and a screenwriter is you get to be kind of a selective introvert. You're by yourself during the writing process, but then while you're turning it into a movie or into a stage production, you gain a family of actors, directors, producers, designers, technicians. With the book, the family is smaller. It's me and my editor, and I liked it. I liked working in the privacy of my imagination and then imagining and now hearing how readers respond in their own private way. You know, I'm not watching an audience's faces during a performance. It's a little bit more of a personal experience than that.
Well, it'd be interesting to watch someone read your book, right? Read your memoir.
Might be a little boring, but I am hearing back from them now. And it is, it's really interesting to hear what they're connecting with in the book. You know, one of the things I've heard is from Latino readers and non-Latino readers alike is, oh my gosh, I knew so little about Puerto Rico's history. I wish I had learned even more. So that hunger for knowledge about this part of American history that's maybe a little undertaught. Also things like a very small passage in the book discusses the history of coerced sterilization in the island of Puerto Rico. Very few people know about this. And I only knew about it because my abuela was one of hundreds of thousands of women who were coercively sterilized in the island of Puerto Rico. So things like this that people are connecting with and want to have more discussions about.
Well, and since you raised that, and I did want to get to that, but since you raised it, you did not know this about your grandmother, and you describe in some detail about what happened to her. Was she willing to have this out in the public for us to help us understand?
I actually inherit her story about that through my mom. I never spoke directly with Abuela about this. I was a child at that time, but she did end up being very forthright after years of silence, decades actually. She was very forthright with my mom about what had happened. And my mom ended up doing national advocacy and awareness raising on this campaign of coerced and forced sterilization, which doesn't just happen in Puerto Rico. When you dig into the history, my book only covers our family history, but sure, when you dig into the history, it's across the United States. So my mother was leading national programs and conferences about this topic. And, you know, Abuela was part of that, a part of her awareness and her leadership there.
Does it still happen today? Do we know?
There are currently class action lawsuits in Canada, in California, and in places in the South for people who have been forced and coercively sterilized as recently as 2020.
2020, which of course is just last year. Well, I would love to, getting back to your story, frankly, and your childhood. As I mentioned in my introduction, you grew up in West Philadelphia, then your family moved out to Malvern. And I'd love to have you read a section. You're just a little kid. You're, what, 5 years old? You're in kindergarten.
Yes.
And I'd love to have you read a passage from the book.
Sure. So here we go. 3 weeks into kindergarten, Mom brought a birthday cake to school. Spongy yellow layers intercut with jam. She had jarred the stuff herself after picking wild raspberries on the farm. A shag carpet of icing covered the thing. Hundreds of florets had been piped individually, painstakingly, as she hummed boleros into the night. The kids saw Mom's copper skin and loose, bouncing afro and turned to me. "Are you adopted?" a boy asked. My guts stove coiled, and I shook my head no. "Then what are you?" he said, genuinely curious. Truth was, I hadn't a clue. To me, Puerto Rico was a past tense island. Jewish was murkier, no place at all, and Dad shrugged any time the word was spoken. Their eyes buzzed with excitement. I resented that in this English-only town, Mom's skin tone and molasses vowels rendered her a headline, and that my difference from her now signified anything at all. "So, what are you?"
I'm half English, half Spanish, I ventured, as if not made of flesh and blood, but language. And it felt okay. The kids seemed satisfied by my declaration.
I love that passage. Does that feel okay to you now that you're, you know, half English, half Spanish? Your language, right?
You know, I feel like I've gained even more halves, so I'm probably like 300 or 400% of all the different languages combined.
But you were one of the few, I guess, children of color in your school, in your neighborhood?
For those 2 years that I was at school in Malvern, yes. And, the passage talks about, I look white and, you know, unlike my mom. So I wasn't even really aware of being a person of color or what that meant until those sorts of experiences, mm-hmm. until I was in a segregated white neighborhood and all of a sudden there was a dissonance between how I felt and how the world around me was.
Well, talk about different worlds. A bit about your parents. Your father, as you described him, was a Marxist, and I guess by association, I guess an atheist. Your mom, a deeply spiritual woman. So these are, again, two very different worlds looking at religion. How did you navigate between those?
That's the whole journey of the book. I think in part, the book looks at the fact that I am raised by a gifted mother. She has a very unusual spiritual gift, and that sets, and I don't share that gift, it sets me off on a path to find my own spiritual journey. And that happens in lockstep with me finding my artistic journey. I can't become an artist until I answer some really deep and confusing spiritual questions for myself. And it's made all the more confusing by the fact that I have an atheist dad, by the fact that I go to college and, you know, at Yale University, spirituality is not exactly seen as like, I don't know, like a high intellectual endeavor. So I feel kind of spiritually isolated there and a little embarrassed about, you know, my mother being a priestess, a santera in Lucumí, about my own Quaker inclinations and my less formally religious spiritual curiosities.
Did you have you resolved that for yourself as an adult now?
I resolved it the moment I became a writer, and my writing practice, in the book, I talk about this discovery that my cousins were that of God within me. That's the discovery. That's the spiritual awakening that helps me become a writer. And so after I've made this discovery, my cousins are that of God within me. Every time I sit down to write, I have found my own spiritual path. It is not my mom's. She is truly gifted. I've seen her predict that someone is going to pass away. I've seen her in spirit possession. I don't have that connection to the spirit world in such an immediate way, but I have found my own way through art.
It's interesting. In the book, you're a young woman, and your mother says to you, you know, why you're interested in music, you're studying music, and she says, but why aren't you a writer? I mean, which I thought was an interest. She seemed to see something in you that perhaps you didn't see in yourself.
I think the hardest thing to do for me is to see inward. I was always a spy on life. As a little kid, I would hide beneath the table or hide behind the sofa and just eavesdrop on what the adults were saying. And this, I wasn't trying to be mischievous. They're saying interesting things. You know, my stepfather, my pop, he's born in Barranquitas, Puerto Rico. They don't have electricity in his town. To me, hearing this was like the best movie I could possibly watch that day or something. So I was always eavesdropping, and I honed my ears so well for what the great stories around me were, and much less well for what was happening inside myself.
Oh, interesting. But has this book sort of opened up yourself to yourself?
You know, as you mentioned, my mom set me on that path. Mm-hmm. She said, "Didn't you ever notice, girl? You're a writer." I was like, "No, I actually never noticed that." And it was kind of embarrassing because I'd already written two musicals.
Exactly.
I was like publishing magazines growing up. I'd written for the Philadelphia Inquirer as a teenager. But to me, this was just the way life was lived. I didn't put a name on it. And she put a name on it and formalized it. And that's what it took. And so, yes, now I think the memoir was in some ways me returning to that process of looking inward without, you know, my mom couldn't do it for me this time. I had to write the book and I had to say, who am I? And does my journey resonate for others out there who are seeking answers of their own or perhaps on a path of becoming an artist?
We're almost up in a break here. She says, how come you never took writing seriously? Why didn't you pursue it for real? You say, I write all the time. And she says, no, I mean, professionally.
I mean, a professional writer, who ever heard of such a thing?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the writers I was familiar with were Eugene O'Neill, you know, Chaucer. I don't know, the stuff that was in my high school Norton anthology at Central High School. Those aren't professional writers. They're just a different category of thing that has nothing to do with me. And my mom mentions the obvious, which is you could have that path too.
You actually are a writer. Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our guest. That's Chiara Alegria Hudis. And she is a writer. She's written a bunch of plays. In fact, got a Pulitzer Prize for one of her plays. She's got a new memoir. It's called My Broken Language. And you can join us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Chiara Alegria Hudis, who won a Pulitzer Prize for her play Water by the Spoonful. She wrote the book for the Tony Award-winning musical In the Heights that will be a movie out in theaters in June. And she's now written a memoir called My Broken Language. And she's joining us on Radio Times to talk about her childhood in North Philadelphia, some of the powerful women in her life, and finding her voice amid a sea of languages. Tell us about the Perez family, and this was your mom's extended family living in North Philadelphia.
Yeah, it was a largely matriarchal family. They had come over from Puerto Rico at various times in their upbringing. So, for instance, my tia Tonya was an adult when she arrived, whereas my mother was still a child. She was 11 years old. And I'm just surrounded by these women that are all very different from each other. But there's some common threads. There's a tremendous amount of celebration and a tremendous amount of suffering. Yeah. And these things happen together, and it's awesome to me to behold. The suffering is about things like poverty, residential segregation, racism, poor health services, gun violence. These are things that affect my family immediately. But the celebration is the wonderful dancing, the natural healing and laying on of hands, the humble meals that are served with joy that are so delicious, and all the oral history and storytelling that happens. So this is the deep end I'm dropped into of womanhood in all of its complication.
And this is what you're watching. As you say, you were a watcher, a listener as a younger girl.
I was watching and listening and maybe a little scared of all of that power I witnessed, maybe a little scared to kind of jump in the fray. So I became the quiet girl on the stairs at Abuela's house. Nice. And I wasn't the only one. Since reading this, one of my other cousins said I was that quiet girl on the stairs too. So we all played our different part. But what I found was that I was actually hungry for those stories and saving them. They were nourishing for me, and then I would go on to share them when I became a writer.
Well, I'd love to have you read another section from the book, which really speaks to what we're talking about here. It's on page 187. And again, this is compared. These are two worlds that you were living in, the world of Malvern, which is in mm-hmm. suburban Philadelphia, and the world of North Philadelphia. And I'd love to have you read that passage.
Yes. So I'm here visiting my Malvern family. Compared to my North Philly cousins, they seemed normal. Over and over, the word tossed like a stone. Normal, normal. The mom and dad under one roof, normal. The 5-minute timeouts and weekly cash allowance, normal. They had egg timers on their toothbrushes. 2 minutes, 2 minutes. Even glimpsing the loneliness in Sharon's insistent smile and the bitterness tossed in dad's junk drawers, my envy of their whiteness chewed me like acid. Even preferring the Perez's corporeal, sometimes criminal parenting to the well-mannered masks of Dad's new living room, still the chorus sounded normal, normal. Filmmakers loved capturing this polite sort of hell. The free library's shelves sagged beneath the picket fence cannon, so that even the dysfunction at Dad's was aesthetic. They were an art house genre. We, the Perez's, merited no novels, films, or dramas. I craved what they had, the routine, the constancy, the ubiquity of stories that explained them. Back in North Philly, mundane routines were fleeting. Everywhere lurked precarity, disruption, the promise of each sunrise. The Perez's were in a constant state of mourning or preparing to mourn because love was a synonym for tragedy. In North Philly, when we protested, did homework, or took on extra jobs, bedtimes were forgotten, meals skipped. In North Philly, no one invited the whole class to a birthday. There was a 50-person family to host. In North Philly, when we danced, we pressed our shoulders against tomorrow's surefire grief.
Again, a passage I just... There's a whole play, is there not, in that particular passage? And I love your description of this, polite, normal, rule-driven world, frankly, a world that I know very, very well, this polite sort of hell.
Yeah. It's that was a hard part to write, because to admit that I was jealous of half of my family's whiteness, it reveals how deep-seated those sorts mm-hmm. of biases even live in my own heart. Those aren't fun things to think about.
Sure. But I can understand as a teenager, whatever normalcy is or normal is, sort of wanting things to be predictable and under control, just because as a teenager, the world just feels so out of control.
It does. And yet at the same time, one of the languages I'm also learning as a child is music. And mm-hmm. I'm learning music by ear, and I'm learning how to improvise. And that doesn't happen so much in a rule-based routine world. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's my Perez family that is kind of prepping me for life's much wilder impulses, more improvisational components. So it does feed my artistry, the unpredictability.
But do they both live in you now comfortably, these two worlds?
Yeah, great question. I don't know. I would have to write another book to discover answer. But yes, no, I mean, look, I've timed my son's toothbrush for 2 minutes this morning.
Okay,
so yes, we embrace order here in my household, but I think the cultural lessons are the ones from the Perez family are ones I feel particularly urgent about sharing with the world, because I do think those are underreported and undertold stories that matter to us as a nation.
Your book is called My Broken Language, and it is about, I mean, broken is such a strong and a word that has so many different, you can say it so many different ways. What does that mean to you? My broken language.
I think of two things. One is this Japanese art form of repairing pottery with gold seams. So cracked pottery that is repaired to actually be more beautiful and stronger because of its history of brokenness. So I feel that there is a beauty. There's just an honesty in the brokenness. You know, none of us are so fortunate to not have any pain. And that's why I put the word my before broken, because it doesn't just let it feel pain. I'm claiming it. I'm claiming my true self, which, yeah, there's a lot of fractures there.
Well, I'd like to have you read another section from the book, and we're jumping ahead now. You are at Brown University, and you have a professor, Paula Vogel, who says something really important to you. Can you read that?
I love this one.
Me too.
The first thing Paula Vogel did was dispel me of the notion that I must be loyal to English. Language that aims toward perfection, she told me, is a lie. Shakespeare knew this, she said, and broke English until its dictionaries grew by 1,000 entries. Tennyson knew it in 1835 when he, the great poet, used one word to express a vastness. Break, break, break. Paula told of a German cab driver who asked his fare where they were heading. To an audition, it turned out. Can anyone go? The cabbie asked. He parked, memorized the sides, landed a role, and grew angry. The theater lied, he decided. Characters spoke in flowery poetry. Peasants and judges had equal vocabularies and elocutions. In reality, Berlin schools didn't give day laborers like him the tools to express themselves. So he became a playwright, his characters often rendered mute by their misery. Your Spanish is broken, Paula said. Then write your broken Spanish.
What a wonderful thing to say to a playwright, right?
It unlocked everything. It gave me permission to not be ashamed of the brokenness, but to find language and vocabulary and creativity and innovation in it.
And new words, right?
And new words, absolutely.
Used to correct your mother's English. You write about this, you know, the words that she used, but you also write, and I love this section from the book, Mom, if you ever read this book and make it this far without disowning me, I ask you one favor. Break this English language today and tomorrow and the day after and bestow it a new life with each breaking. Endow your fullness upon this cracked colonial tongue, your language genius. This is your English. You earned it. I am only a guest here.
Yes, my mom's English is so beautiful, but because it's her second language, I used to kind of gently tease her. I would correct her, you know, and then writing this book is when I really realized, well, hold on a second. Who taught me this English that I have now made my life writing in? She did. She did. Her music did. And that really humbled me to have that turnaround and realize that I owe this English to her and that she had to earn this language in a way I've never had to. And therefore, in some ways, it more belongs to her than me.
And that is Chiara Alegría Hudis, who is a playwright, a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. She has written the screenplay to the movie adaptation of In the Heights. She wrote the script for the Tony Award-winning play, and she's got a new memoir, and that's what we're talking about. And it's called My Broken Language. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Manya tweeted, were there any parts or chapters of the book you cut? And if so, how did you make those decisions?
So many parts I cut. Oh, my gosh. Listen, I first wrote 70 pages of this book that aren't even in the book, and I love them. I thought this book was going to be a story of my life as a professional playwright, and so that was the first 70 pages I wrote. And then I cut them because I thought, actually, before I get to the professional life, I want to get to the childhood and the mm-hmm. histories that I lived through. And that happens in some ways just with my own discoveries as I write. And then I also had an editor saying, but is this the real story? Is this the story? You know, he's pushing me hard, Chris Jackson at One World, to keep digging deeper and deeper and deeper. He's kind of relentless in terms of pushing me further inward.
You feel vulnerable now that it's published and we're talking about you?
Especially the parts that deal with the struggles, I do still feel vulnerable. I am hip to the fact that things like poverty, residential segregation, addiction, these aren't finite closed doors in our past. You know, even though our family has survived so much, people in recovery, people whose health is thriving now, the pain of those moments still lives very much in us in those histories. And so it's, I'm aware that, yeah, there's a vulnerability in bringing up painful topics for sure.
You went to Central High School and began writing plays when you were at Central. I think your first play was performed in, 10th or 11th grade?
10th grade,
10th grade. What was it about?
It was called My Dreams About Girls, and it was about the fact that growing up in a West Philly duplex, there was an alley separating me and the adjacent building. And I used to dream that a girl would move in at the window across from my bedroom window and we'd become best friends. Mm-hmm. So based on that premise, you know, it was a little play. And I was at Central High. My boyfriend, who I fell in love with at Central, he wrote a play too. And his play was about being so bored in physics class that time actually goes backwards. And so, you know, Central High, he's mentioned, there's a little bit of a love story mentioned in the book too, but we're still together today. So playwriting is also, in addition to a great way to express your heart, your community, your spirit, it's also a great way to find love.
Absolutely. I mean, lucky you, I guess I should say. You also, when you went to Yale and talk about being in a very different world, let's say from North Philadelphia or West Philadelphia, you were studying music there.
Yes. I have loved music from the time I was a child and listened to many different kinds of music. And it was a shock to get to Yale. And I had never been in a space that only allowed one kind of music. So I got to continue with my studies of Chopin. I got to continue with my studies of Bach. But as far as the more folkloric music I had been steeped in, Juan Luis Guerra, bata music that was part of my mother's spiritual practice, rock and roll that came from my Aunt Linda in New York who taught me, those things, I had to check that at the door. And at Yale, the vibe was music is not for dancing. It's for sitting and listening to and for analysis. And I think in part, I started falling out of love with the thing I had loved my whole life because of that. It just felt too isolating. And writing, I can see with hindsight, started creeping in as a way to reclaim my story and not feel that I had to siphon off entire parts of myself at Yale.
So words gave you something that notes could not?
The reason I wrote a musical at Yale is because it was the only way. If I wrote about Puerto Rican characters, then my teachers couldn't tell me I couldn't write music that involved those sorts of traditions. I wasn't really aware of it at the time, but that was my strategy, I think. It was like, well, no, I'm going to find a way to bring my music into the academy. And that's how I did it, by writing a musical. I became a playwright by kind of necessity.
And do you think we are, I don't know how many years ago you were in college and in graduate school, but does it feel like we're in a slightly different place when it comes to this Latina culture?
I couldn't speak for Yale because I haven't been a student in so long, but I do know that I am far from alone in terms of being a Latina to publish a book this year. I have met so many and read so many other brilliant Latino writers of various backgrounds telling their story. And really, that's what you're hoping for. You know, a world where there's only one Puerto Rican book, it's insufficient. You need many Puerto Rican books, you need many Mexican-American books, you need many Dominican books, and then the story becomes richer of what this nation is.
And what does your family think of this memoir?
Well, let's see. My sister called me in tears when she read the chapter about her being born. I was 13 years old when my sister was born, and I witnessed it, and it changed me forever. And she had never heard the story of her birth.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
She had never heard about being a slimy newborn placed right on top of mom's breast and feeding for the first time. So, you know, that's one of the things that happened.
But you also say, and this is what happens with memoirs, is writers tell secrets about families. I mean, maybe willingly or wittingly or unwittingly.
I think intentionality is really important. I'm not trying to tell a salacious story here. Actually, what I'm trying to do is tell a story of survival. And so any family kind of secrets I'm discussing are really more just like the things that we are quiet about because the larger culture has vilified us as a community and has mischaracterized us as a community. I can write about addiction if I'm doing it through the lens of recovery, because I'm telling a story of our survival, and it impresses me, and it is not easy. Okay. I've done a few impressive things. You know, I've had some academic accomplishments. I've had some writing accomplishments, but the survival of the women in my family impresses me on a much deeper and more humane level. And so any things I'm writing about very private elements are in a spirit of saying, this is how we survived and this is what we survived. And damn it, it's amazing.
It is amazing. And after this very short break, I have one more reading that I'd love to have you do from your book. And again, Chiara Alegría Hudis is our guest. She does have a new memoir. It's called My Broken Language. She also is a playwright. She is now a screenwriter. She wrote the book for In the Heights, which is going to be in movie theaters come June. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Chiara Alegría Hudis about her new memoir. It's called My Broken Language. Chiara, I'd love to have you read one more section from the book. Your readings are terrific, by the way. And this is about the Perez family, these amazing women.
Yes. Though the Perez women wore clothes when necessary, they were butt naked, half naked, and somewhat exposed a lot, too. Any given day at Abuela's, half the jeans would be unbuttoned because, ay, comadre, ya tú sabes, PMS, heat stroke, menopause, and Abuela's exagerada servings kept us trapped in perma-bloat. After an L ride north through the desolate landscape, my matriarch's bodies were natural wonders. Nucci's eroded cheekbones were my Grand Canyon. Mom's thigh jiggles, my Niagara Falls. The tattoo on Ginny's breast, my Aurora Borealis. North Philly's vast, vacant stretches of blight were increasingly visible from each house Abuela migrated to. The female Perez form stood out against the gray rubble, fulsome and bold. Facial moles like cacti in the Sierra, front tooth gaps like keyhole nebula, the cellulite rippling over their butts shone with a brook's babbling glimmer. The sag of each tit, big ones and small, like stalactites of varied apocal formation. Stalactites! Upper arms of all shapes, sizes, and textures, like varied river stones. And oh, swoon the guts. Abundant flabdomens, some inhabited by earthworm-shaped stretch marks. Brown bellies like Philly's own half dome and black hairs.
And again, that's our guest reading from her memoir. I love this idea of these these wonderful bodies as a kind of a landscape?
Well, our roots in Puerto Rico were agrarian, right? So my abuela had a farm, and my mom, one of her daily chores was to bring her papi a cup of coffee out on the farm. And she would observe his methods. I think I'm the girl who was on the steps, but she was the girl watching her papi farm. Uh-huh. So we do have some of those observational tactics kind of in common. And he would teach her bit by bit. You know, he was a Taíno, and he would teach her the indigenous science methods he had cultivated over time. He had never stepped foot in a schoolroom, by the way, but he was a master of certain agrarian techniques. And what happens to people, earth women, to earth people when they move to a city and then through gentrification get pushed farther and farther north, away from any green space, away from any public parks? All we had left, you know, our bodies were the only plots of land that we had left to cultivate. And we did. And it was beautiful to behold.
You founded with your cousin, Sean Ortiz, something called Emancipated Stories. Help us understand that. And then we'll talk about In the Heights.
That's a more recent development. One of the things, you know, in the book, in My Broken Language, I'm talking about things that were affecting the community a lot in the 80s and 90s, like AIDS, addiction. More recently, I think mass incarceration has really started to encroach in our communities too, in the Latino community. And so with my cousin Sean, I was like, let's do something. It affected our family. You know, we had cousins locked up, and these are good people who, you know, might have made a mistake, but we're still merited connection with the larger society. But, you know, that's not how mass incarceration works. It's kind of out of sight, out of mind. So Emancipated Stories is a way to just hear, to encounter one page of a life story of someone who is currently behind bars and to connect with the humanity there. So we have in our Instagram page, we have hundreds of entries there, and it's growing every day.
And this is with your cousin, right? Sean Ortiz?
Mm-hmm.
Is he in prison?
He is no longer. While he was inside, I found that letter. This was my sweet little cousin. He helped me grieve when we lost family members. We would play G.I. Joes together, and he was a very loving and very intelligent child. When he went to prison, I found that something, you know, talking on the phone was good, but letters, like physical pen on paper, it was different. I could feel him hungry for the letters. And that's how I kind of came up with the idea. I said, would this be helpful for people to share these actual pages? And we could write them back and say, hey, we shared your page with the world. We shared your page with this audience. And so he actually helped me inside start to spread the word and start to get entries. And then Greaterford was open at that time too, a Pennsylvania prison where a lot of juvie lifers were. And my Philadelphia, I kind of activated my Philadelphia advocacy circles, and they helped get me entries from Greaterford. And so it actually started as a Pennsylvania thing. It's nationwide.
And it's called Emancipated Stories.
Yes.
Let me ask you about your working with Lin-Manuel Miranda. And this was for In the Heights, which is like 12, 13, 14 years ago. How did you and he end up working on this together? And you wrote the book, the script for the musical.
Yes. So I came to New York in 2004, ready to try being a playwright for real. And I was writing plays out of the Latino community in North Philly. And he was writing a musical in the Latino community in Washington Heights. And a producer got wind that we were both working on these things and put us in a room together.
Wow.
And it didn't take very long. You know, something that happens in North Philly or whenever we go to Puerto Rico is like, you meet people and you're trying to figure out if you're related. It's like, oh, tú eres Pérez. You're a Pérez person from Arecibo. And you start tracing this back. And it kind of felt like that the first time I met with Lin, which was like, are we related? So we started working on In the Heights together way back in 2004.
Gosh, that's almost 20 years ago. I saw a couple of interviews that you did, and I loved the kind of relationship you had with him. I think you called each other cannibals in that, you know, you would write something for the, you know, to be spoken, and then he would take it and turn it into a song, and vice versa.
There were each moment. It would be an exception for a moment in the musical to have like that was the first way we tried it. Basically, each moment in the stage show is the result of I would try it as a scene. He right. would steal one of my lines and write a song, but the song didn't totally work. So I would take verse 2 and 3 and turn them into a monologue that I thought maybe would be more the direction it should go in. And it becomes this real, yeah, cannibalism. I guess another right. way to put it that's less gruesome is kind of like a relay race. We're passing the idea back and forth and back and forth until we really get to a place where it's like, this is it. This is how this works, you know? And that happens over years. Yeah, and as you had mentioned, he wrote the music and lyrics. I wrote the script or the libretto. It's called a book, but that's very confusing because people think it's like a novel or something.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and so, yeah, there are scenes I've written that are just, I basically stole a song of his and turned it into a scene. And there's songs that he's written that, you know, he stole my scene and turned it into a song. And that's how it becomes something that we create together.
And it went from off-Broadway to Broadway and now to movie theaters that are finally beginning to open. What was that like? I mean, to have this so much larger stage, and to be honest with you, I got a screener, so I was able to see it, and you see, you know, these scenes on the streets of people dancing at the, you know, in such the most joyous kind of way. But did that feel like a much bigger canvas for you?
It was so exciting. The fact that we were able to film in the Heights, in Washington Heights, was an incredible experience, and not just film it there, but actually find a lot of our dancers in the community, mm-hmm. find a lot of our extras in the community. So we gained relationships. I mean, I live here also in this neighborhood now. And so I was meeting neighbors I had never met before who are such talented artists, and we were making a movie with them together. And when you're talking about 300 extras in a swimming pool scene, dancing hip hop underwater with underwater
cameras.
Very
impressive. Yes.
It's like, wow, how did I pull this off in my life? Okay, this is cool.
Almost like Busby Berkeley. I mean, parts of it, just, you know, which is, of course, so much fun. And I also like the fact that when you see the dancers, they're not all, you know, perfect. These are the kind of bodies that you just read to us about. These are actual people's bodies dancing.
I mean, bingo, you really honed in on something that was so important to me in casting. I don't know much about dance, but the choreographer let me and asked me to be part of helping choose the dance ensemble. And before we even got a body in the room, you put out casting calls and dancer calls. And even how you word them affects who comes out. So I said, we have to put language in that we want elderly dancers, because if we just see young, hot bodies dancing in the street, it doesn't actually reflect the reality of the community. My elders danced my whole life growing up, and it's awesome to see. So I said, I want elderly dancers, and I want body diversity, very important to me, to reflect who we are as a people, these gorgeous bodies that are all distinct from each other, that don't fit some sort of cookie cutter mold, showing that, you know, they got moves.
In the movie and in the play, I'm not sure in the play if she was named Nina Rosario, but nonetheless, she's the young person from the Heights who goes to college and feels a bit out of her element there. How much of that was based on you? How much of that feels autobiographical?
A lot. And I think that's an experience that Lynn and I both shared. You know, when I had spent a lot of time in Malvern, and I was very familiar with the white communities. You know, I don't want to imply that I had only lived in a Latino bubble, but basically I was like in a lot of diverse spaces, and I got to Yale and all of a sudden that was not the case. And it was kind of shocking to me. I hadn't really been prepared for less diversity than I grew up with at Central High in Philadelphia and my family's. And it was isolating. Mm-hmm. I think that is part of why, again, this playwriting mattered to me so much, because it wasn't until I wrote some plays that featured Latino characters, then all these other Latino students came out to audition for it. And I made a community there of Latino scholars that
that I loved, and that became a really important part of my time at Yale. So yeah, my story about my fish out of water story, Nina Rosario, that's in part, that's me.
Someone says to her, A's are your revenge. Was that ever said to you?
No, it wasn't said to me. I had to make that line explicit. I was like, you know what? No one needed to tell me to get A's because I was like such a book nerd. I just did it on my own. Oh, they were just like, wow, good job.
Let me get Rafe to join our conversation. And Rafe, go ahead on line one from Bryn Mawr, actually joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Rafe. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I was Joe Phillips' friend and companion for the last 5 years. He was the head of the English department at Central, and he spoke of Chiara. He was a modest guy, and he didn't brag, but he remembered you and thought of you as one of his accomplishments. Wow. And one of his favorite students.
That's really nice. So I thought, that's really nice, Rafe. And his name was Joe Phillips?
Joseph Phillips.
Joseph Phillips.
Head of the department at Central.
Let me be very clear here. First of all, I'm trying to speak through tears because you caught me off guard with this. He was not Joe Phillips to me. He was Dr. Phillips. And he was a teacher who changed my life forever.
Wow.
He expected something more from us students than just read the book and answer these pop quizzes. He expected us to do a deep personal inquiry into literature and how it connected with our lives. And there are chapters in my book in which I describe him reading a poem out loud like he loved it. There's chapters in my book where I describe him giving us an essay assignment and it being an unforgettable moment in my life because I almost go into a trance in his essay test. So he was an angel in my life. And I'm glad I got a chance to say thank you.
That's really nice. You're working on a new movie, Life is a Carnival. What is that about?
This is a really fun movie. So Warner Brothers has the entire Fania catalog, and they came to me. Fania, of course, is the birth of a New Yorkian musical movement. It's a record label where this term we think of as salsa, which is actually a conglomeration of many different Latin American beats. It's the label that Ruben Blades, Celia Cruz, I mean, you name it, these greats were Hector Lavoe, Willie Colon. So they said, what do you want to do with this music? I said, well, I don't want to write about the stars that made the music. I want to write about the everyday people who listen to the music. So it's actually a story about women in leaving Puerto Rico and coming to Philadelphia as they listen to these songs and what their journeys were.
And Philadelphia, obviously, I mean, Philadelphia is your life, right? Even if you live in New York.
It's, you know, it's the cradle of our democracy. Okay. That, you know, when the quote unquote founding fathers came to Philadelphia, it had been a thriving and very diverse Native American community. Then, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, gets written on that land. Yeah. We know that founding fathers like George Washington, you know, were kind of illicitly hanging with their slaves in Philadelphia. And then, you know, fast forward a few hundred years and here I am with my family and my own American story. I mean, how could I not continue to dig into that complicated, troubling, and extraordinary history? It's very rich material.
Well, it's such a pleasure, Chiara Alegría-Hudis, to have you on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
It's really a pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And her new memoir is titled My Broken Language. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Today's engineer is Diana Martinez. Radio Times producers are Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. Let's close the show with Anthony Ramos singing In the Heights.
Cousin running, just another dime a dozen. Mom and pop stop and shop. And oh my God, it's gotten chewed on hot. Like my man Cole Porter said, people come through for a few cold waters and the lottery ticket. Just a part of the routine. Everybody's got a job, everybody's got a dream. They gossip as I sip my coffee and smirk. The first stop is people hop to work. Bust it, I'm like $1, $2, $1.50, $1.69. I got it. You want a box of condoms? What kind? That's two quarters, two quarter waters. The New York Times, you need a bag for that, the taxes added. Once you get some practice at it, you do rapid mathematics automatically. Selling maxi pads, fuzzy dice for taxi cabs. Practically everybody stressed, yes, but
checks and wonder what's next.
In the Heights, I buy my coffee and I go.
I buy my coffee and set my sights on only what I need to know.
I need to know.
In the Heights, money is tight, but